Good afternoon. I'm Mark McClellan. I'm the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform here at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to today's webinar. This webinar is convened as part of a cooperative agreement between Brookings and FDA to explore issues related to the development and implementation of the Sentinel Initiative. As many of you know, these webinars, this series of webinars, provides a forum to discuss a wide range of initiatives that relate to active surveillance. And we've got a very important topic within the general issue of active surveillance today. We're going to provide an overview of the Medical Device Epidemiological Network, MedEpiNet, which is an initiative launched by FDA to develop the infrastructure and methodological approaches to improve FDA's ability to monitor the performance of medical devices. And as you'll hear about today, this is actually a collaboration between FDA and a number of outside experts. Conducting post-market surveillance of medical devices presents many challenges beyond some of the challenges that we've discussed in other webinars that pertain particularly to drugs and biologics. Some of these are in fact unique to post-market device surveillance. For example, outcomes associated with medical devices may be influenced not only by features of the device, such as its material and design, which can evolve over time, but also by circumstances surrounding its use, such as a surgeon's level of skill and familiarity with the device. In addition, medical devices are often used in conjunction with other procedures and interventions, which may make it difficult to attribute the outcomes to a device in particular. Now, up to date, the types of data that are typically used for post-market surveillance don't fully capture information about medical devices, the particular model and other unique or important identifiers for devices, with a level of specificity that that I think many of us would like to see. MedEpiNet has been working to develop the necessary capabilities for device surveillance, addressing all of these types of issues through the creation of a network of investigators both within and outside of the FDA to harness a broad spectrum of expertise and experience and data in this general area. So today's presentation is going to provide an overview of this important initiative and its role in a comprehensive post-market national medical product surveillance strategy. We'll also include an update on MedEpiNet's progress and its pilot projects to date, as well as a discussion about its future direction. This is going to be an online web presentation. At this point, all of your lines should be automatically muted, but if you could please confirm that your phone or computer is muted, we'd appreciate it. To mute your phone, you simply press *6 or the mute button. To unmute your phone, press *7. So that's *6 to mute, *7 to unmute. And along the way, throughout this webinar, we encourage you to use the Q&A tab at the top of your screen to submit questions. You can do this again at any time during the presentation. These questions or comments we put into a queue, and then we'll call on them later on during this session and ask you if you're available to state your question. At the very end, if time permits, we'll open up the lines for those of you who are participating only by phone and don't have the webinar access to ask questions. If at any time along the way you have any technical problems, please call the Brookings IT Help Desk. That's at 202-797-6193, 202-797-6193. So today we've actually got five presenters reflecting the collaboration inherent in MedEpiNet. We'll start with Denitsa Marinak-Debic, the Director of the Division of Epidemiology in the Office of Surveillance and Biometrics at the Center for Devices and Radiological Health at the FDA. We'll also hear from Mary Beth Ritchie, the Associate Division Director in the Division of Epidemiology at CDRH, and Ben Eloff, Senior Scientific Program Manager in the Division of Epidemiology at CDRH. They, Denitsa, Mary Beth, and Ben are going to be joined by Fred Resnick, who's the director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratory at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, as well as Art Sadrakian, who's an associate professor of public health and the director of the Patient-Centered Comparative Research Program at Weill Cornell Medical College. And both Art and Fred have been extensively involved in these active surveillance efforts for devices for quite some time. After these presentations, we're going to open up the line for questions. And again, you can submit questions or comments at any time during the presentations using that Q&A tab at the top of your screen. So since we've got a lot to get through today, I'd like to turn this directly over to today's presenters. And I think that begins with you, Denitsa.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you all for joining this webinar. We are very excited to be able to talk about the MD EpiNet initiative and hopefully give you some interesting insights in terms of what's happening in the devices world. First, I will present on behalf of the MD EpiNet core here at the Division of Epidemiology, and then again, as Mark had said, the PIs from our Methodology Center and Infrastructure Center, Drs. Fred Resnick and Arthur Drakian, are going to talk about specific projects. And then Benilov is going to cover the MD EpiNet public-private partnership, because ultimately our goal is to create the partnership that will be self-sustainable and be able to increase the collaborative efforts that we currently have between the FDA and universities. So I'd like first to start with perhaps putting the MD EpiNet in the post-market context. And I know that this slide probably does not give, at first sight, a lot of information, or at least it's not readable for many of you, but I hope that you will be able to look at this slide more closely even after the seminar. I would like to maybe draw your attention to some of the concepts and key messages that we wanted to present today. What is presented on this slide is really the current data sources that we have available for medical devices. As you can see on the top of the slide, we have MDR reports that CDRH receives as part of our post-market passive surveillance system. We also have enhanced surveillance system that we use for a number of our post-approval studies. In addition to that, we have a condition of approval studies program or post-approval studies that are mandated at the time of PMA approval that typically involve de novo data collection, which means that individual sponsors receive the order at the time of the PMA approval, and as per that mandate, they collect data to satisfy the FDA requirement. In addition to that, we have administrative claims data, we have electronic health records, we have device-based registries, we have the secondary analysis of already collected data, and we have disease-based registries. What we are trying to portray on this slide is really how we envision these data sources to be utilized in the next two decades. And as you can see, for example, just to use as one example, the de novo data collection, which is currently the primary mode of data collection for the post-approval studies, we anticipate that to actually decrease in the future because more and more we are going to gain access to other data sources, and with the UDI rule, we are going to actually be able to increase our capabilities to do device-specific research. So essentially, what we envision for the next two decades is going to be a combination of device-based registries, electronic health records, administrative claims data, embedded registries, and certainly the analysis, secondary analysis of already collected data. And in some instances, we are going to be relying also on disease-based registries. Again, Mark already started talking about the differences between devices and drugs, and some of the my co-presenters today certainly are going to even enhance this point. But for this beginning of the presentation, I just would like to remind us all that drugs and devices are very different. Here we listed some of the points that are different not only from the ways how devices are regulated, but also from epidemiologic perspective, what are some of the issues that are related with the exposure to devices as they are different with the exposure to drugs, and what is different between the total product life cycle in drugs versus those with devices. The laws governing drug regulation from both pre-market and post-market process and the requirements are very different. What is a requirement for pre-market world of drugs, such as multiple RCTs, are not the norm for the world of devices. Devices law allows, for example, for a broader interpretation of valid scientific evidence. And many devices can reach market by bench comparison testing to a predicate, which is certainly not the case in the world of drugs. I also wanted to share with you our recently launched website. Last Monday, we were happy to see that the MD EpiNet website had been launched, and I encourage all of you to go to the website where you're going to be able to see the information that relates to the context of MD EpiNet. Also, you are going to be able to see the specific projects and the work streams, some of the future steps that we are planning to undertake, namely in toward the direction of public-private partnership. And you will be able also to see some publications that had been already published that talk about some of the pilot projects that we have undertaken. And you also will be able to contact us with some suggestions on how we can improve and what some to share with us some ideas for the future. So let me start with the mission of MD EpiNet initiative. Keeping in mind all these differences between the drugs and devices and clearly the gaps in both infrastructure and methodology for medical devices, we have envisioned the infrastructure and innovative methodological approaches for conducting robust studies to improve medical device safety and effectiveness understanding throughout the total product life cycle. And here on the next slide, you can see the specific objectives for MD EpiNet initiative. First of all, we would like to improve the paradigm of how medical device knowledge is utilized throughout the device life cycle. And although this may seem as a very general objective, I'd like to take you to the direction and just bring your attention to the to certainly recent criticisms that the FDA had received in terms of how the knowledge that had been accumulated in medical devices throughout the total product life cycle had been evaluated in the past. And certainly many external experts and our internal reviewers pointed toward that there is a gap in terms of specific silos that existed within the center or within the agency in terms of how we evaluate the evidence for medical devices. And we wanted to change that paradigm and to be able to talk about TPLC as a continuum, learning from the examples that and knowledge that we have learned through preclinical, pre-market clinical trials, post-approval studies, registries, electronic health records, administrative claims data, and all of this to be able to contribute to the systematic evaluation of the evidence and CDRH decision-making. That's objective number one. Objective number two, we wanted to leverage partner resources and expertise to create a sustainable, robust infrastructure through which stakeholders will continue to gain valuable knowledge about medical devices. What we mean by that, and certainly the focus here, is on sustainable and robust infrastructure. We, in the past, have developed many very productive relationships with academia and other stakeholders. However, we wanted to create a sustainable infrastructure, a robust infrastructure, and the infrastructure that will allow the stakeholders to be able to learn from us and for us also to be able to learn on a continuing basis from our stakeholders. And finally, the third objective is to become fully integrated in the systematic evaluation of medical devices and CDRH decision-making. By that, I mean to expand our research capabilities to be able to allow the CDRH to learn from our research and to be able to make to help the CDRH to make decisions based on the epidemiologic evidence evaluation. And on the next slide, you can see specific approaches. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about them because you will see and hear from the next presenters. But just to make sure that I capture the most prominent ones, we put a lot of accent on the development of innovative methods for evidence synthesis to be able to identify evidence gaps, specific questions, methodologies, and best practices, and to develop and test innovative methodological approaches for medical device research and regulatory science. And finally, we would like to disseminate the findings to all stakeholders. The next slide presents the conceptual framework for MD-EpiNet. And as you can see, and this is a graphic presentation on what I have already talked about, is that there is a very strong relationship between the CDRH epidemiology program and MD-EpiNet partners. So we do anticipate to work very closely with our colleagues from other from external stakeholders' bodies to be able to identify what are the gaps in the current evidence, and also to identify the need for new real-world studies to fill the gaps, or to build the research consortia that will help us address the questions. And finally, to translate the results for regulatory decision-making and dissemination to patients and clinicians. And with that, I would like to turn the podium to Mary Beth Ritchie, who will talk about methodology workstream.
Thank you, Danita. So right now, the overarching goals, the mission, the vision, and the objectives of MD-EpiNet are being conducted through various work streams. And these are overarching tracks by which many of our projects take place. Right now, these work streams comprise most of our contracts. The methodology work stream is housed mostly at the MD-EpiNet Methodology Center at Harvard University, and is comprised of three overarching projects. The first is evidence synthesis, by which we can obtain safety and effectiveness estimates, develop and apply modeling techniques, and translate the results into a useful TPLC model. The second of which is patient-centered outcomes. And here, this is a way to compare adverse events between different groups to account for important device, operator, or patient characteristics, and to utilize this data as well. The third option, the third project area in the methodology workstream, are the existing gaps. Here, we take different device areas, we identify gaps in the existing data sources, and look to develop more sustainable infrastructure and methodology for addressing these gaps so we can better evaluate medical devices in the future. Our second workstream at this time is the infrastructure workstream. And this is housed at the MD-EpiNet Science and Infrastructure Center at Cornell Weill Medical College. One of the major aspects of the infrastructure work stream is the International Consortium of Orthopedic Registries, or ICOR. Under the current contract, ICOR is looking to do harmonization and classification with unique device identification, as well as to have three different demonstration projects for bearing surfaces, for femoral head size, both in hips, as well as for fixed versus mobile knee joints and for pediatric joint devices. Our third major work stream at this time is the unique device identification work stream. And right now this is incorporated within both the Methodology Center and the Science and Infrastructure Center. UDI is looking to identify the challenges and opportunities with implementing the unique device identification system, and then to demonstrate the capabilities for use of the system within both electronic healthcare records and in registries. So the current contract looks to develop a roadmap to tell us about potential hurdles and best practices. And then there are demonstration projects in the cardiovascular realm in electronic healthcare records, as well as demonstration projects in the orthopedic realm for orthopedics, or in the orthopedic realm for registries. And I'd like to turn the podium over to Dr. Resnick.
Hi, I hope folks can hear me. This is Fred Resnick calling in from Boston. So I'm going to present a bit of information about the Methodology Center, the MD Methodology Center, and this is housed at Harvard Medical School, and my co-principal investigator is Dr. Sharon Lees Norman. And I'm going to skip a couple of slides just in the interest of time, but you know, one of the premise, the major premises of all of the Methalogic work is that no medical device can be designed to be perfectly safe, and obviously there is example after example that usually hits in the lay press of devices such as the implantable defibrillator leads, the metallic hips, and even the coronary stents that have had tremendous notoriety about the uncertainty of the safety, or in fact the demonstration of lack of safety after some experience with the device in the post-market phase. As Denitsa had pointed out, there's obviously significant differences in the approach to safety monitoring for medications, which do have national device or drug identification systems in place that are used and available in claims records. And this is in contrast to the devices where, as Dr. McClellan had pointed out, we do not yet have uniform identification, and the UDI initiative is certainly underway, but it will take several years for this information to make it to the claims data sets that are being used so successfully on the drug surveillance side. As it has also been pointed out, the great challenge in implantable device safety monitoring relates to the relationship between the device itself as well as the procedure, since the devices are often implanted and by physicians and surgeons of varying degrees of experience and skill. Just to point that out, a very simple demonstration of the learning curve with a particular medical device, which we've seen in now many devices, was explored in the American College of Cardiology data set looking at a novel vascular closure device. And in an unadjusted analysis, we can see an improvement in the successful implantation of this device over the course of the experience of various centers. So this is institutional experience with a device. And when we break this down to the experience on average for a particular operator, so this is the average operator experience, we can see a very dramatic improvement with a little bit of undulation at the beginning, which we find interesting, in the experience, in the successful deployment of this device, with the improvement in performance from 92% successful deployment to virtually 100% after about 230 deployments. And I think this enormous difference between the initial success with a device and the final success of the device, depending primarily on the experience of the operator, is a dramatic difference that needs to be accounted for when considering and evaluating the safety of new medical devices. Moving on, the Methodology Center at Harvard seeks to understand these influences and develop evidence-based regulatory science by developing novel approaches for combining information, identification of the methodologic gaps, and studying the comparative effectiveness and safety of existing studies. A second priority for the Methodologic Center, as mentioned by Dr. Ritchie, is one part of the two parts of the unique device identifier demonstration project. So on the Methodologic Center's effort, we wanted to develop an end-to-end purchaser-to-point-of-consumption UDI tracking system utilizing health records and clinical registries. We'll be able to show you a little bit about that moving forward. So we have several investigators, statisticians led by Dr. Sharon Lees Norman, the epidemiologist, by Miguel Hernan, Sebastian Schneeweis, Laura Hatfield, I should not have skipped, as well as myself, and Dr. Joe Drozda at Mercy Healthcare System, all participating in the Methodologic Center. In terms of developing evidence-based regulatory science and surveillance, I think Dr. Denitsa had already sort of described much of what we are focusing on, looking at selection of candidate devices, developing protocols for evidence abstraction, and development of methodology to combine information, and then also to evaluate the existing resources for evaluation of medical devices, identifying classes of the devices and the device sources, evaluation of the gaps in the approaches, identification of databases, of and the development of new methods, and as a proof of concept to apply these methods to selected devices. We're going to develop statistical methodologic tools to use both retrospectively and prospectively, work with our collaborators, multidisciplinary investigators, and a variety of data sources in a virtual warehouse of post-approval surveillance information. One example of a methodologic approach, which may have value in the emerging data sources that Denitsa had pointed out over time, is an active surveillance method of monitoring one device after it's introduced into clinical practice against a concurrently used device. And so this is the data out of a Massachusetts registry of coronary interventional devices, and this is along the x-axis here is the calendar quarter, and the y-axis is the proportion of patients exposed to a device who had a particular complication. The device happens to be a drug-coated stent, and the complication was the rate of post-procedure myocardial infarction. The range here in blue is the sort of acceptable range, that is the propensity-matched concurrent control that of an alternative device adjusted for multiple comparisons. And the points, point estimates shown in green and then in red, are those observed event rates for the device of interest. And what this graph shows us is that there is a continuing out-of-boundary condition for the new device as compared to the comparator device that began early after its implantation and after adjusting for about 38 or nearly 40 clinical variables was a sustained difference between the rates of post-myocardial infarction post-procedure, which could not be accounted for by the adjustments that we were capable of making with the data set that we had. And this type of analysis, we think, may offer an opportunity for prospective, continuous, and automated surveillance in the data sets that will become available over the near term. Extending that concept, working with Dr. Bob Hauser in Minneapolis, using the same software, which is the Delta system, we explored the rates of ICD failure looking at the Fidelis lead. And this is looking retrospectively at the lead, but the data loaded prospectively into the system. And what we could see is, as compared to the traditional lead, the Quattro lead, another Medtronic lead, that had a very low failure rate over time, over the 60 months of the study, the Fidelis lead rapidly demonstrated a significant higher failure rate. And in fact, if we look at when we first noticed this difference in the data set, it was certainly well before, 36 months before the voluntary recall, and it is this potential time savings, that is available through active surveillance of appropriately detailed clinical registries that I think we're all interested in achieving. And very quickly, the Unique Device Identifier Project, the demonstration project on the cardiovascular side is led by Dr. Joe Drozda of the Mercy Healthcare System. We're going to be looking at coronary artery stents using a UDI-based surveillance system embedded into the electronic health record, and use this demonstration project to identify obstacles to implementation of a UDI roadmap and assess the validity and utility of the data obtained from the electronic health record. The Mercy Healthcare System includes 34 acute care hospitals in the center of the United States, about which the rest of the country pivots. And just in terms of conceptual design, in conjunction with a group of stakeholders who are quite motivated to see the UDI concept implemented in the entire stream from the business processes, from the development of an order all the way through the implantation of the device to the billing of that device. These stakeholders and the healthcare transformation group, along with input from FDA and the UDI task force, will work in conjunction with the device manufacturers and existing standards to develop a UDI demonstration project for coronary stents that will track the stent and the device from the point of ordering all the way through the point of implantation to the patient, and allow this device to be studied and allow us to go back and find out which patients got which device through our routine interrogations of the various systems, information systems. The last point was just the structure of the Methologic Center. So FDA actually is contracted to the prime contractor is CNI, and then Harvard Medical School led by Dr. Norman and Dr. Hatfield with involvement from Brigham and Women's Hospital, the School of Public Health, and then the Mercy Healthcare System for both the methodologic as well as the unique device identifier efforts. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Sedrakian.
Thank you, Fred. I hope everybody can hear me. So the Science and Infrastructure Center and Methodology Center have shared responsibility for advancing these data systems and also advancing the analytic aspects of medical device research. So it's primarily housed within Weill Cornell Medical College and Kaiser Permanente Surgical Outcomes and Analysis Group. So in collaboration between Kaiser and Cornell, we intend to think about both conceptual frameworks but also kind of data infrastructure needs that we need to build to create the data systems of the future. Because without really having the data and relying on existing resources, there's very little we can achieve. We're limited in terms of device information that has been collected in existing data systems, including professional society registries. There's really a superficial level information that we have within existing data infrastructure. And most of the data systems we have are voluntary and not necessarily suitable for a long-term vision of how robust infrastructure that Denisa was talking about would look like. Some important aspects of our work is to also think about the frameworks for device evaluation. Fred alluded to the important factor of learning that happens when you work with the devices, and also particularly when in surgical technologies, that is very different from drug studies, pharmaceutical studies. So one of the interesting conceptual frameworks that we're working with and trying to adopt it for device research is called IDEAL. That's in the back of this slide. You'll see that has four stages in the concept that IDEAL has. The innovation has four stages, such as coming up with an idea, the developmental stage, the exploration stage, the assessment stage, and then a long-term study stage. It's very much applicable to the way we think about device innovation and the fact that innovation and evaluation should go hand in hand as we come up with the new innovative products and implants. Initial stage will involve some kind of a registry that will capture the particular learning of an inventor. Then as we have few other surgeons or interventionists join in and there is more learning that is happening, a larger data infrastructure will be established. It can be, again, in the form of registry and a stage of exploration. For example, further learning happens. At a stage of assessment, we can embed cohort designs or randomized clinical trials within a registry. And finally, in a long-term study stage, we can think that safety surveillance can be done using a particular data infrastructure such as registry. So that's the general conceptual framework, which really includes this total life cycle, total product life cycle approach that Denise also talked about, that at each stage of the device innovation, we should be able to think about type of studies and methodologies that need to be developed that will address particular needs, and really to recognize that comparative studies might come only at the stage of assessment. That is not always needed if device has a dramatic, is able to dramatically improve the outcomes of a particular condition. So that in the front, you see this another conceptual framework we developed for both evaluation of evidence from clinical trials, but also how observational studies and real-world studies can advance further the evidence. And important factors that we outline in this conceptual framework is to think about patient characteristics, device factors, think about hospital factors and surgeon and intervention characteristics, along with an access and media factors that are important impact on outcomes. An interesting example of this last one, for example, the media factors, a well-known metal-on-metal failure that has been discussed in the media and also in medical journals, certainly has an impact of publicity when patients' fear and physicians' concerns can lead to offering revision surgery at a lower threshold than they would have done otherwise. It's just an illustration of that potential. So, again, one of the key components, as you've seen from that total life cycle product life cycle approach, which is the ideal that we're trying to innovate and adjust to the device innovation setting, is really a registry concept. The registry definition from AHRQ handbook. But for the critical issues that we want to answer is, does any registry investigation need to be this hypothesis-driven studies that people are interested in, and comparing observational study with RCT or not? We believe it has totally different purpose. So it's not the best way to confront observational study to an RCT in the context of this data repository and continuous improvement mechanism that registry is offering. And the important aspects of also should we build national and nationally representative registries or product registries? We certainly believe that efficient infrastructure for device safety surveillance and really innovation in the setting of devices needs to involve a national data system. And preferably it should be a mandatory kind of data system registry rather than voluntary, when individual biases and other conflicts of investigators can influence the reporting in a voluntary system. So those are important thought processes we have in this data infrastructure development. A key slide here, next one, that shows that, again, UDI is going to have an important role in the future as we think about how device registries will be evolving and we're building this infrastructure in the country. And EMR-based data systems, certainly in the middle, are important, but we should also pay attention that potentially claims-based data that can be very helpful in future in thinking about if UDI is incorporated within claims, there would be alternatives to to EMRs in building this registry. And in addition to that, there might be an entry at the side of clinicians' provision of services. So clinicians might be also should be important part of the registry development. So certain registries might be based on paper. You don't have to have an EMR, or you don't have to even think about a claims-based system, but really paper-based system has proven to be very reliable ways of building national registries, particularly overseas. So we think about more broadly and think about condition-specific registry development and data system development here. So the two important issues that we'll be working on within our infrastructure center is the UDI initiative that that Denise and Fred talked about before. So we will collaborate with Brookings in thinking about developing a roadmap for UDI implementation in the country, and that's important because, again, this has both the component of methodology but also policy and outreach, and I hope that would be a successful collaboration in designing a comprehensive roadmap for implementation of UDI, not only within electronic data sources but also nationally based on the concepts that I discussed before. A second component, which is testing the concepts of registry development and even taking it to a new level, is to this issue of international consortium of orthopedic registries. We really think that in certain situations with even national data system infrastructure is not enough. It has to be international because of the smaller sample available, I mean, and it's smaller size of potential registries in each country. We need to have much larger scope and collaboration worldwide to be able to have enough data to prevent disasters from happening in future. And within orthopedics, based on particularly this example of metal-on-metal problems and disaster, we came up with this concept of I-Core, and we will implement a distributed data analysis system that will help us to not merge any data systems, but will allow us to work collaboratively and address safety and effectiveness of devices. Our first study certainly will focus on bearing surface, but we'll also look at the additional questions within knee surgery and hip surgery. We currently have over 3 million patients included in the registries within I-Core worldwide, includes 14 plus nations and 29 plus registries that are collaborating. At this point, we have for bearing surface tested a distributed kind of analysis software within three, one large, one mid-size, one smaller registry. And as we smoothen all the and make this collaboration seamless and communication seamless, we'll roll it out to all of the participating registries who have relevant information to contribute to this comparative analysis. This is just a description of homogeneous data collection among the registries. Certainly for some variables, there is a variability, but so for some key variables, most registries seem to collect information that can be combined. And after harmonization of these data elements in terms of definitions and outcome events, we will be able to conduct these studies and disseminate the results of these investigations. That concludes my part of the presentation.
Thank you, Art. This is Ben Eloff from FDA. In the interest of time, I'll go quickly through our slides here. The first question we'll pose is why public-private partnerships? And rather than go through these points, I'll just say they make intellectual and economic sense. We all live in a resource-constrained world, but we can all bring diverse viewpoints, knowledge, and abilities to bear on a problem, and together through partnership create something that is greater than the sum of its individual parts. This slide shows where various sectors come to a partnership in their missions. The FDA has a certain mission to ensure the public health through regulation of medical products. Academia and other government agencies have an interest in promoting scientific research. Industry wants to get the best devices on the market as possible. And patient societies and payers and public health in general wants the best healthcare available. Together, we all partner for the better public health. This slide shows the conceptual framework, organizational framework for MD-EpiNet as a partnership. You can see in the center an advisory group, which is the committee of the whole, all partners, to whom the MD-EpiNet Operations Committee, the real backbone of the partnership, would report. They have some operational duties to the right, and the rest of the work streams, which Mary Beth mentioned earlier, all report in. Who do we want to have partner with us in MD EpiNet, or indeed in any public-private partnership? Definitely other federal agencies with whom we're already in partnership, our academic partners, patients, professional societies, industry, third-payer hospitals, and any and all interested and or affected stakeholders. Altogether, we ensure that the partnership is driven by scientific need and is scientifically rigorous. Is also through transparency, fair and inclusive, and of course compliant with our regulations. Of course, saying this is easier than doing it. Coming up with scientific problems and the willingness to address those issues is the easy part. Getting the resources and project plans and people to buy into deadlines for these things across a variety of stakeholders and a variety of cultures can be difficult, and that is where the partnership work is done. So some keys to a successful collaboration. Broadly stated, be transparent, be fair, be inclusive. Make sure that we talk openly and are responsible and reported to our constituents and other decision makers.
And I would like just to conclude with this last slide, which outlines our next steps. Stay tuned for the series of FDA public meetings that are going to be conducted May 14, 15, 16, and 17, where we're going to focus those public meetings on National Post-Market Surveillance System for Medical Devices, Medical Device Epidemiology Third Annual Conference, and also public meeting that focuses on registries and their role in the national surveillance for medical devices. Also, on the website, you will see the link to the existing RFA opportunity for those who would like to apply. And then in terms of the public-private partnership development, again, we are going to be able at these public meetings to talk about the final business plan that we are about to adopt and hear your comments on that business plan. And with that, we will conclude. We apologize for going a little bit over time. Thank you.
Oh, Denisa, thanks very much, and Ben, Mary Beth, Fred, all of you for covering a lot of ground in a limited amount of time, and also letting everybody know about next steps to find out more, since a lot seems to be happening. I wonder if I could start off with one question. I'm not sure who this would best be directed to. You all mentioned a few early applications, pilot applications to test out the capacity around some orthopedic devices. You showed some results from ICD leads. Have you all identified the first areas for, or the next areas for pilot applications yet, or is that still in process?
So this is the first in series of contracts that we actually have. Again, you will see the RFA announcement, some of the thoughts, and where we are going with the next direction. But again, we are always open for good suggestions, and none of our decisions have been final. So by all means, for those on this call and the ones that are interested in communicating with us, we would be very happy to hear your thoughts.
Okay, thanks, Denisa. And we have a question from Bob Giffen. Bob, if you're still on, you can press *7 to unmute and go ahead with your question. *7. And Bob, if you're not with us, Bob's question was emphasizing that most of the registries so far, at least, have been safety-focused. And given especially that a lot of the evidence on medical devices doesn't come from prospective randomized trials, He was interested in asking whether effectiveness endpoints will be included at some stage of the process, or whether this is viewed, at least for the foreseeable future, as primarily a safety-focused effort.
I'll start, and then I'll certainly have others to join in their comments. From the medical devices perspective in the post-market setting, what we expect from the registries is really to give us information about a benefit-to-risk balance for medical devices throughout different phases of TPLC. So the short answer to the question is yes, we will be doing also studying effectiveness, and which we view as an essential component of risk-to-benefit balance.
Thank you. I finally got my phone on the
Okay, good. Bob, did that answer your question? Any follow-up?
No, that's good for now. Thank you.
Okay. And thanks for the response. Wanted to ask a bit more about the UDI, Unique Device Identifier, efforts, which understandably is a key part of the early initiatives here. You all spoke in some detail about piloting efforts with UDIs using hospital-based electronic medical records and incorporating that into registry systems. And Anita, you mentioned at the outset that there also are some prospects for incorporating UDI information into claims. I'm wondering if you all could talk a little bit more about how you see claims data potentially fitting in with these efforts. Does it require finding a solution for UDI inclusion in claims? If so, is that are there piloting plans for that? If not, are there what are the alternatives?
But we know that some claim systems, especially CMS, already have their forms ready to go for UDI. And so their collection mechanism is already set up and ready for us to pilot when UDI comes through. However, as we're moving toward having UDI be available, we know that there's a lot of groundwork that has to happen first. And so these pilot projects are part of that. And we think that having UDI within not only EHRs, but also within registry systems will help us to leverage all of these initial steps so that when UDI is available within claims, we can use that as well.
And Mark, those workshops and think tanks that the bookings will be leading certainly are going to be a critical component of this overall effort. So basically, you know, you will be leading the effort on helping us get where we would like to go. What we were able here to gather the experts from academia to be ready for the demonstration projects and certainly test pilot some of these approaches. But the Brookings certainly will be leading the way toward the national roadmap for UDI. And I personally, and certainly my colleagues from CDRH, look very much forward to working with you on this important initiative.
Well, and I'm looking at my staff around the room here. They're excited as well. One related question is there are clearly a lot of interest in partnerships from or potential partnerships from healthcare providers, researchers, and the like. You mentioned the device manufacturers as well. What's the sense of the interest from some of the health plans in this effort, some of the private sector payers? You mentioned that Medicare has claims that are ready to go, but obviously you're going to need the private payers as well for that would help with involvement as well.
Mark, I can answer this as Art Sidrakian, if you can hear me.
Yes, go ahead.
So certainly, I mean, one of the important payers and that has been interested in particularly kind of UDI implementation is Kaiser Permanente, and is part of our subcontract, major partner in both within UDI and also kind of the registry building initiative. So certainly there is interest from some of the healthcare delivery, like integrated delivery organizations, to think about implementation of UDI. That what I can say from my end. And I think one issue that came up again, including in claims, it sounds quite easy kind of to put UDI in claims, but we have to be selective. And I think what's important with the overall that leadership with UDI that Brookings will be undertaking, to have a clear message as to what kind of devices we're talking about. During a single intervention, there might be hundreds of devices that are used. So obviously, and they will have all unique device identifiers, they can all not be captured in a claims data system, right? So it should be priority kind of based system that we need to advise them to think about.
Great. Thanks for those clarifications. I have a question from Anna McAllister Slip. Anna, if you're still on, you press star 7 to unmute and go ahead with your question. Star 7. And if not, Anna's question was, are you planning on incorporating patient-generated or patient-provided data into the registries, and if so, any specific plans on that at this point?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Is that Anna?
Yes, this is Anna. Okay. Sorry about that.
Okay.
It didn't go through for some reason at first. Yeah, I mean, you just asked my question. I'm a patient advocate on the CDRH Diabetes Devices Committee, or Advocacy Committee, or Advisory Committee. And I'm very interested. Obviously, I use lots of different devices on a regular basis. And there's a degree of variation in the efficacy and stability of these devices. And I'm very intrigued by this process and very interested in seeing it evolve and excited. But I don't see how the registries or the data collection methods listed so far are incorporating data from patients.
That's a very good question. I can tell you that we have recently put together the proposal and obtained the funding from Critical Path initiative here at CDRH to look at patient-reported outcomes in the area of orthopedic devices and how we can harmonize both the exposure and the reporting of those outcomes to the registries. And collaboration certainly is going to include all of our registries from the ICOR consortium. So it's going to be a joint effort that will include a lot of clinical input, statistical, patient, and epidemiologic input. Hopefully, we're going to move this field a little bit to the right direction. You're absolutely right. There is a huge gap and huge need, and this is not something that can happen overnight. But I think if we demonstrate that this can be done with this type of consortia, then that I think we have shown the way to the positive direction.
I would encourage you to consider the diabetes community as part of this, because we all generate lots of data and are very cognizant and informed about the data that we do generate. And I think you would have a very enthusiastic response from the diabetes community if you went in that direction as well.
Will do. Thank you.
Okay, Anna, thanks very much for the excellent question. I'd like to thank all of you who joined us this afternoon for the webinar, and particularly our presenters, Danita, Ben, Mary Beth, Fred, and Art. Covered a lot of ground in a limited period of time. For those of you who would like to get further information, I remember that the presentation materials, including the audio, are going to be posted on our website at Brookings within the next few days, and you should also feel free to email us with any further questions or comments. We will have another webinar next month, and you should look for an announcement about this in the near future. We hope you'll be able to join us next time as well, and we look forward to your participation in all of our future events. Thanks again for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.